From the Voice of America in Washington, this is VOA Global. Hi, how you doing? Glad to have you with us. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in our final week. We'll have more on that coming up in just a little bit. Also coming up, Daybreak Asia, Afghanistan's president asking for patience in the pursuit of peace, the politics of earthquake aid to Nepal are airlifted courtesy of Michael Lippin via Asian Political Scene. China Focus with Sarah Williams delves into the Indian Prime Minister's visit to China. Incarcerated moms sing to their children as we hear in the American Cafe with Ira Melman. A simple operation is making children smile all over the world. That's on today's edition of Now with David Byrd. Planning for a manned mission to Mars, Rick Pantaleo suits up on Science World Express. We have business and sports as well. It's all coming up on today's edition of VOA Global. This is Daybreak Asia, a summary of Asia news and events for Monday, May 11th. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson. Among today's headlines, Afghanistan's president has asked people to be patient and hope for progress in pursuit of peace in his country. We hear more now from VOA's Aisha Tanzim from Kabul.
Afghanistan's President Ashraf Ghani reminded people the region had a history of conflict and cross-border interference.
The legacy of the last 36 years was hard because South Central Asia did not have agreed upon rules of the game.
The whole region, he said, needs to redefine its policies.
A fundamental change of this kind requires some patience.
Ghani is facing strong criticism from supporters of former President Hamid Karzai for becoming too close to Afghanistan's eastern neighbor, Pakistan. President Karzai often accused Pakistan of providing safe havens for terrorists that carry out cross-border attacks. His supporters say Pakistan has not changed its behavior, but Ghani defended his policies.
There's been an undeclared state of hostilities for 13 years. This must end.
Analysts say he has taken a calculated risk by changing the discourse on Pakistan. In return, he expects Pakistan to use its influence with the Afghan Taliban to bring them to the table to negotiate peace. He also expects Pakistan to give up its support of the Afghan Taliban.
Sovereign states that recognize each other, that have embassies, that interact, and that call each other friends, do not destabilize each other. Do not resort to non-state actors for achievement of destabilization.
Pakistan insists it does not support any militant activity inside Afghanistan. Recently, it condemned the Taliban spring offensive and publicly asked the Taliban to talk to the Afghan government. Taliban members attended a recent round of open discussions in Qatar on ways to find peace. This has raised hopes in the region a negotiated settlement may be reached between the warring factions. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Kabul.
International organizations and non-government groups in Nepal are warning the devastation caused by the April 25th earthquake has left thousands of girls and young women vulnerable to human traffickers. As Ron Corbin reports for VOA, anti-trafficking campaigners say there is a need for greater attention to the protection of girls and women.
Hundreds of thousands of people in Nepal remain without shelter and possessions, leaving poor women and girls desperate and vulnerable to human traffickers, say activists. Non-government organizations, NGOs, say the criminal networks are especially targeting Nepal's rural communities, even using the cover of relief efforts to kidnap or lure women away. The United Nations says up to 15,000 girls are trafficked each year from Nepal, forced into sex work as far away as South Korea and South Africa, although the vast majority are lured to India, where thousands work in brothels. Anuradha Koirala, founder of the anti-trafficking organization Maite Nepal, says children are especially vulnerable amid the ongoing attention on relief and rehabilitation.
All the areas which have been affected, these are the areas which have been affected very badly and where 80% of the children are trafficked. Very few people are concentrating on this issue. So we think that these children are the most vulnerable. We have to save them and we have to take care of them. We ourselves have already rescued 3 children.
The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, is calling for the creation of temporary places for learning, saying almost 1 million children are not able to return to school due to damaged buildings. An estimated 24,000 classrooms were damaged or destroyed in the earthquake, the most severe to hit Nepal in 80 years. A U.S. State Department report found Nepali women and girls faced forced labor in Nepal and India as domestic servants, beggars, factory workers and mine workers. Some find themselves in the adult entertainment industry. Others are trafficked to Malaysia, Hong Kong and South Korea and even the nearby Chinese district of Khasa. The report said while Nepal had failed to comply with the minimum standards for the elimination of trafficking, significant efforts were being made. But campaigners fear the gains may now be lost following the April 25 earthquake. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
In India, the political opposition to efforts to overhaul land purchase laws is posing a threat to the government's plans to boost the economy. The government says the new proposals are crucial to acquire land to build infrastructure and other projects, but opposition parties have slammed them as anti-farmer. Anjana Pasricha has more from New Delhi.
At the heart of the controversial legislation is the government's proposal to exempt defense, industrial, rural electricity and affordable housing projects from getting the consent of 70% of farmers whose land has to be acquired. The tough consent clause was introduced during an overhaul of land laws in 2013. The government says that provision stalled scores of projects. To streamline the sale of farmland for development, the ruling party introduced an amended bill in Parliament on Monday. However, the government's proposal to ease laws for acquiring land has encountered unexpectedly fierce opposition from the Congress Party and activists. Speaking in Parliament, Congress Party leader Rahul Gandhi accused the government of neglecting farmers. He says the government is ignoring the difficulties faced by farmers. Gandhi says everyone knows that it only represents the interests of industry and influential people. The government counters this by saying that building roads and factories in rural areas will industrialize poorer regions of the country and open up new avenues of employment for impoverished farmers. Venkaya Naidu is Parliamentary Affairs Minister.
Today, no farmer wants his son to be in agriculture. The reason is the agriculture, because of variety of reasons, is becoming unremunerative.
Supporters of the bill point out that the government is trying to cut red tape and speed up development. Opponents say it will benefit industry at the expense of poor people in India's vast rural areas. Political analysts say the country's fractious opposition parties have united to paint Prime Minister Modi's government as pro-business and anti-farmer. The difficulties in passing the land law underscored the challenges that Prime Minister Modi is encountering. Although an executive order has been issued, the government will need to pass the land bill in Parliament. But with opposition parties refusing to come on board, its lack of majority in the upper house of Parliament remains a stumbling block. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Daybreak Asia has been a weekday feature of VOA for the past several years. It comes to an end this week. We thank you for listening. Be sure to stop by voanews.com for these and other stories from the Asia region and around the world.
Value your comments and your feedback, and that's why we put it so high up in our show. You write to us via our website, voanews.com, to the stories that we post each and every day. We thank you for that. One of the stories we have up right now on our website, President Barack Obama hosting a summit next week of the six Sunni-led member states of the Gulf Cooperation Council, expected to focus on the Iran nuclear deal and Tehran's involvement in conflicts from Yemen to Syria. For leaders of the Gulf countries, scenes of Iran-supported Houthi rebels overrunning Yemen's capital, Sana'a, and driving out its U.S.-backed government this year were a sign of a rising threat from Iran, and they come to the summit seeking reassurances of U.S. backing. Dr. Valerie Debaltseff from Russia writes, this is a conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran. either can co-opt Israel wins. You've seen Egypt is now dead. Turkey is firmly in the Muslim Brotherhood grip. Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait, insignificant corruptions. The only real power left in suspension is Israel, he writes. One of the other stories we have on our website, a U.S. lawmaker encouraging Hong Kong legislators to veto electoral rules proposed by Beijing. In a recent interview with VOA, New Jersey Republican Representative Chris Smith says he supports a threat by Hong Kong pro-democracy lawmakers to block the Beijing-backed reforms, which would allow all voters in the autonomous Chinese territory to choose their chief executive for the first time in 2017, but only from a limited pool of candidates. James Chi Yi from San Jose writes to us on our website, what is the motive of the USA interfering in China's internal affairs? Your opinion counts. You can leave them with us at voanews.com. We'd love to see them and read them. This is VOA Global from the Voice of America. We're glad to have you with us today. As I mentioned at the top of the program, this is our final week of VOA Global and final week for many of the podcasts that you hear on this program, as we will be moving to a new format revolving around our International Edition program. So we hope you continue to tune in to VOA for that. But you can always follow us on Facebook. That's not going away. VOA Asia Facebook. We're glad that you've stopped by to look at it so far.
You're listening to the Asian political scene on VOA Global. I'm Michael Lippin. When a huge earthquake shook Nepal last month and killed thousands of people, its two giant neighbors, India and China, were quick to send help. That assistance included rescue workers, security personnel, and aircraft, resources lacking in Nepal, one of the region's poorest nations. James Moriarty was the U.S. ambassador to Nepal from 2004 to 2007. Now based in Hawaii, Moriarty spoke to me recently via Skype. I asked him what was motivating India and China to provide the aid, a feeling of sympathy, a genuine friendship, or a competition for influence over Nepal.
Well, I think you get all three going. I mean, that's a good question because all three of those probably play a role. Obviously, the scope of the disaster is getting covered daily in China. China, by the way, probably had about 4,000 or 5,000 tourists in the country when the disaster hit. India has these deep historic ties with Nepal, people to people. There's probably 3 million people who could claim Indian citizenship inside Nepal, and there are probably 3 or 4 million Nepalis inside India. So there's this long history of cross-border connections, similar religions. There is, as you're trying to imply, a degree of competition, but also a degree of pretty important interest that both countries see in Nepal. With China, this is the country that borders on Tibet. Tibet is a huge portion of Chinese policy. They want to make sure that when the Dalai Lama passes away, you don't get some sort of uprising that is fed by a neighboring country, and frankly, Nepal fits that bill of a neighboring country. With India, they see a stable, friendly Nepal as an anchor for the border with China. So they've both got big strategic interests there that they're obviously trying to protect through this.
And on the Nepalese side, how do they perceive the relative importance of relations with India and China? Do you get a sense that they feel one of those two is more important than the other?
I think if you ask that question, almost all Nepalis would say that India is more important for the reasons I've cited before, the linguistic ties, the economic ties, despite this boom in trade with China, are still much, much greater with India than they are with China. And India has a history of playing a pretty decisive role in Nepali politics at various crucial points.
I also spoke recently with George Varughese, a Nepal-based representative for an international development group called the Asia Foundation. Varughese gave me his view of why India and China rushed to help the Nepalese.
I would say that the assistance being provided by both is coming out of a good place. I think both countries have developed in recent years the ability to provide disaster relief to the neighborhood. India was even quicker than the Nepal government in providing relief. Their plane was in the air and landed in Nepal within hours of the event, bringing with it search and rescue teams. And I have said before to other media outlets that Indian and other assistants have in fact jump-started the Nepal government's own response to relief. So I can't really say that any of this has ulterior motivation, except that these are both powerful neighbors. These both have an interest in exerting influence in the neighborhood. I think all countries have that interest in their foreign relations. I think they're doing it in the best possible way that they can by assisting Nepalese. And if you go out on the streets, the average Nepali is very appreciative of both countries and their attempts to extricate people from the rubble, especially because they brought specialized equipment and teams to do so.
That was George Varughese of the Asia Foundation. For each week since last November, the Asian political scene has examined major developments in regional politics with the help of the analysts and commentators who know them best. But we're now ending this segment as we prepare to relaunch our International Edition program next week. I'd like to thank you for listening over the past 5 months and hope you'll join me for more conversation about Asia and other global issues on our new shows. I'm Michael Lippin.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi makes his first official visit to China this week as part of an Asian tour that includes stops in Mongolia and South Korea. The key objective is boosting economic ties, including ways to level the trade imbalance now in China's favor. Mr. Modi will visit Beijing, Shanghai, and the northern city of Xi'an, May 14th to 16th. Trade between the two Asian giants runs about $70 billion a year. President Xi Jinping visited India last September. IHS chief economist Rajiv Biswas tells VOA's Victor Beatty, Mr. Modi views China as a key to help reignite a lackluster Indian economy in need of infrastructure improvements.
Prime Minister Modi regards China as a key trade and investment partner for India, and his agenda will be very much to continue to build on the economic cooperation that's already been set in train during previous discussions between the Chinese and Indian leadership in the last year or so. I think he's very interested in China helping India in infrastructure development, particularly China's high-speed trains is one area. Power infrastructure is another area, and also in helping him with his plan to build 100 smart cities in India, because he's very aware that China has done a lot of urban infrastructure development over the last decade, and he wants to tap into that capability, which India doesn't really have at the moment.
Doesn't India have a large trade deficit with China, and will he try to bridge that gap by getting greater access to the Chinese market for Indian goods?
That's exactly right. India-China trade has boomed in the last 10 years, but it's been very much in favor of Chinese exports to India, whereas Indian exports to China are more limited to a lot of commodities as well as services exports as well. There are important other areas of cooperation. For example, Tata, the auto manufacturer, has invested in building an auto plant in China to manufacture Land Rovers. So there are important areas of cooperation that have already happened between Indian manufacturing and China. But I think there's a lot of room to further build up bilateral relationship in trade in goods in particular. And what Modi will try to do is get greater market access for Indian manufactured products in the Chinese market, which I think China will also be keen to try to develop as well, because they would also recognize that it's a relatively asymmetric kind of trade relationship right now.
The Modi trip, however, is overshadowed by two bilateral border disputes. Arunachal Pradesh and Aksai Chin, a Chinese foreign ministry spokesperson, described as a huge dispute. And Kit Panda is deputy editor of the regional current events publication, The Diplomat.
The border talks are actually a major focus of this visit, and that's new in a sense, particularly for an Indian prime minister going to China. The last time an Indian prime minister visited China, that was Manmohan Singh. That was in October 2013, if I have my dates right. And the reason he traveled there was to finalize the Border Defense Cooperation Agreement, which was a crisis de-escalation mechanism. With the Arunachal Pradesh dispute, things are quite difficult. Narendra Modi's government, while they do emphasize good relations with China and economic development, has given attention to developing Arunachal Pradesh. India administers Arunachal Pradesh as a state, as part of the Indian Union. It's an inhabited area. Plenty of people live there. It has its own state government. It's completely regarded as a normal province within the Indian Union. Whereas Aksai Chin is currently administered by the Chinese. It is a strategic artery between Tibet and Xinjiang. There is a little bit of symmetry there. China administers one of the disputed territories. India administers the other. So, you know, one of the proposals that has been floated is to do a simple swap based on who administers the territory now. I don't think we'll see anything like that on this visit. I'd be very surprised if that happened. But I think we'll certainly see rhetoric towards a peaceful resolution of these disputes at an early date, as the diplomatic language goes. I think I would keep my expectations low for what Modi will actually return to India with on the border dispute front.
During President Obama's visit to India earlier this year, he and Mr. Modi pledged to work together to ensure the freedom of navigation, maintain maritime security, and keep airspace safe in the Asia-Pacific and Indian Ocean regions. Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
From the Voice of America, this is Asia Business News. I'm Jim Stevenson. Toyota Motor Corporation and Mazda Motor Corporation are in talks to expand their technology partnership to fuel cell vehicles, according to sources on Saturday, as global automakers face rising costs to comply with stricter emission regulations. The two Japanese automakers already have a technology and production tie-up, and Toyota was now considering providing fuel cell and plug-in hybrid technology to Mazda. Mazda, in return, was considering offering its partner fuel-efficient gasoline and diesel engine technology under its proprietary SkyActiv series. Mazda has been trying to develop FCVs on its own, but it's decided to team up with Toyota, which produces the world's only mass-market fuel cell car currently. China cut interest rates for the third time in 6 months on Sunday in a bid to lower companies' borrowing costs and stoke a sputtering economy that is headed for its worst year in a quarter century. Analysts welcomed the widely expected move, but predicted policymakers would relax reserve requirements and cut rates again in the coming months to counter the headwinds facing the world's second-largest economy. The Consumer Prices Index increased 1.5% from a year earlier, missing the median estimate of 1.6% in a Bloomberg News survey of analysts, a release from China's Statistics Authority showing in Beijing. The Producer Prices Index fell 4.6%, extending a record stretch of declines. Food prices climbed 2.7% from a year earlier, while non-food costs were up nearly a percent. From a month earlier, consumer prices, though, did decline 0.2% in April. Producer prices were again dampened by a slump in mining. That's a look at Asia Business News from the Voice of America. This is VOA Global from the Voice of America. You know, a Phoenix couple has claimed responsibility for putting two fake skeletons sitting in lawn chairs in the Colorado River in far west Arizona, according to authorities on Friday, and a story that we told you about last week. The husband and wife have been identified. They approached the La Paz County Sheriff's Office earlier this week and revealed how the skeletons in their closet ended up at the bottom of the river in Parker. The lieutenant said that they were nervous at first, thought they might be in trouble, but when they finally came in, they brought a photo as proof that they were the ones who put the skeletons in the bottom of the river. The pair, who may identify themselves publicly this week, came forward after seeing all of the media attention surrounding the skeletons. The sheriff's office has no plans to file any charges, since the skeletons were not endangering anyone. They try not to encourage people to do this kind of thing, but it was relatively harmless, according to the sheriff's office. It was in deep water. They were wedged between some rocks, and there was no reason to expect that somebody would find them. Well, somebody did. A man snorkeling in the river near the Arizona and California border spotted the skeletons. They were about 40 feet down, and believing that they were actual remains, he contacted authorities. It soon became clear, though, that they were fake. The skeletons were wearing sunglasses, with one holding a sign that includes the words Bernie and the dream in the river. Although the entire sign was not legible, the sign also had the date August 16th, 2014, so apparently they had been down in the water for some time. They thought that Bernie was likely a reference to the movie Weekend at Bernie's. In the 1989 film, the two main characters lug around their dead boss for days, losing and recovering his body several times. And at one point in the film, Bernie's corpse falls off of a boat and into the water. We're about to fall into the latest world news with Michael Lippin next.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Coming up, Macedonia's president says a deadly gun battle in the country's north was part of a major terrorist plot. The UN Children's Agency says tens of thousands of Yemeni children are at risk of death as the country's conflict drags on. And the U.S. Congress prepares to decide what to do with a controversial domestic surveillance program. I'm Michael Lippin. Macedonian President George Ivanov says police have prevented a terror attack by battling an armed group in the country's north. Saturday's battle in the Macedonian city of Kumanovo left 22 people dead, including 8 police officers and 14 gunmen. 37 policemen were wounded. President Ivanov told a meeting of the Macedonian National Security Council on Sunday that the gunmen were trying to cause chaos and fear in the country. Kumanovo is in an ethnic Albanian area of Macedonia north of the capital, Skopje. It's unclear who the gunmen were. A police spokesman told the French news agency that authorities suspect them to be mostly Macedonian citizens led by 5 ethnic Albanians from Kosovo. Macedonia's ethnic Albanians launched an insurgency in 2001 for more civil rights and autonomy. Yemen's Shiite Houthi rebels say they have accepted a 5-day humanitarian ceasefire proposal from Saudi Arabia, which has been fighting the rebels since March. The Houthis announced their acceptance of the truce on Sunday. It is set to take effect in Yemen on Tuesday. Earlier Sunday, warplanes from the Saudi-led coalition bombed the residence of former Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh in the capital Sana'a. Saleh later appeared on Yemeni television standing in front of the rubble. Some loyalists of Saleh have allied themselves with the Houthis. The Saudi-led coalition has been trying to restore Yemen's current exiled president, Abdurabu Mansour Hadi, to power. The UN Children's Fund says a severe shortage of fuel in Yemen is hampering the delivery of essential aid to the Yemeni people, leaving children especially vulnerable to deadly diseases. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva on what UN officials say is causing the fuel shortages.
Yemen imported 90% of its food requirements and much of its fuel before the conflict began. As the war was heating up, the UN Security Council passed a resolution mandating all commercial imports into Yemen be inspected to make sure no arms were being delivered. Spokesman for the Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Laerke, says this is the main obstacle to the import of adequate amounts of fuel and other aid.
This means it has a crippling effect on the humanitarian operation. Even though we do have pre-positioned stocks in the country, we're simply unable to get it out to the people in need because we can't transport it.
UNICEF spokesman Christophe Bouillerac says Yemen's fuel supply could run out in less than a week.
If restrictions on the commercial imports of food and fuel continue, then it will kill more children than bullets and bombs in the coming months.
Bouillerac says 120,000 children will suffer severe acute malnutrition over the next 3 months if health and hygiene services that rely on a steady fuel supply do not function normally. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel has called on Russia to do more to urge pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine to abide by a ceasefire with the Ukrainian government. Ms. Merkel made the appeal to Russian President Vladimir Putin when the two met in Moscow on Sunday. The German leader flew to the Russian capital to pay tribute to Russian troops killed in World War II. She was the only prominent European leader to join Mr. Putin in Russian ceremonies this weekend, marking the 70th anniversary of the surrender of Nazi Germany. A Polish exit poll has indicated that President Bronislaw Komorowski finished second in Poland's presidential elections, behind conservative challenger Andrzej Duda. The poll by Polish national media was released moments after voting closed on Sunday. It gave challenger Duda nearly 35% of the vote, while predicting that Mr. Komorowski won just over 32%. No official results have been released, but if the exit polling is confirmed, Poland will stage a May 24th runoff vote between Duda and the incumbent president. Many analysts had predicted a runoff vote after what they described as a lackluster Polish campaign that focused on national security and domestic issues. Cuban President Raul Castro visited the Vatican on Sunday to personally thank Pope Francis for the pontiff's efforts to end 5 decades of tension between the United States and Cuba. The Cuban leader met with the Argentine-born Francis for nearly an hour as the two men spoke in their native Spanish. Francis, the leader of the world's Roman Catholics, was instrumental in the secret negotiations between Havana and Washington, leading to December's announcement that the two countries were taking steps to reopen embassies in their capitals. The Vatican has said Francis personally mediated between Cuba and the U.S. and hosted delegations from both countries. Well, Cuban President Castro said he thanked the Pope on Sunday for what he did and praised his wisdom, modesty, and all his other qualities, as he put it. Well, here in the U.S., this week brings increased pressure on U.S. lawmakers to reform or reauthorize the National Security Agency's ability to gather domestic telephone records for anti-terrorism purposes. That program expires at the end of this month. As VOA's Michael Bowman reports, a federal appeals court recently ruled that the so-called bulk metadata collection is illegal, but it did not order a stop to the NSA program.
Even before last week's court decision, some in Congress were urging reform of domestic spying. Patrick Leahy is the top Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee.
I believe we have to protect our national security, but we also have to protect our civil liberties, which make us unique as a country.
Exposed by fugitive former NSA contractor Edward Snowden, the program caused a firestorm when Americans learned of vast telecommunications monitoring by a shadowy U.S. agency. Last year, President Barack Obama pledged what he called a new approach.
The United States is not spying on ordinary people who don't threaten our national security. And then we take their privacy concerns into account in our policies and procedures.
The program reportedly collects and stores phone records, but not the content of calls made. Moments after the court ruling, several Republicans rushed to the Senate floor to defend the NSA endeavor, including Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
The NSA can find connections from known terrorists overseas and connect that to potential terrorists here in the United States. Critics of the program either want to do away with it or make it much more difficult to use.
Many expect the Supreme Court will ultimately decide the constitutionality of bulk data collection. In the meantime, Congress could extend the NSA program or reform it. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
And that's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin.
I'm Jim Stevenson with business news from the Voice of America. Britain's presence in the European Union is judged as positive by 58% of the French, while 37% see it as a handicap, according to a recent poll. Young people are most positive about their neighbor, with 79% of respondents aged 18 to 34 seeing UK membership in the EU as an advantage. That's compared with 48% of those over age 50, according to a BVA poll for iTelevision. Overall, 72% of the French have a good image of Great Britain, but still only 20% say they want French leaders to be inspired by Britain's economic and social policies, and 63% said they paid little or no attention to Britain's recent elections. British Prime Minister David Cameron won re-election last week and has promised to renegotiate the terms of the UK's membership of the EU and hold a referendum on whether to remain within the bloc by 2017. Greece needs at least a symbolic show of progress at Monday's meeting of euro area finance ministers in Brussels to persuade the European Central Bank to keep emergency funds flowing to Greek banks at the current pace. The next hurdle comes just a day later when Greece has to pay about $840 million U.S. dollars to the International Monetary Fund. Greek Prime Minister Tsipras met with top cabinet ministers for several hours Sunday to brief them on negotiations. Athens expects the Eurogroup to officially acknowledge important progress, according to a Greek government official speaking on the condition of anonymity, as the talks happen to be private. The Prime Minister and his ministers confirmed the need for a mutually beneficial deal within the framework of the government's mandate, according to that official. That's a look at business news from the Voice of America. Around the world, children are sometimes born with a deformity called cleft palate. It's a condition that can cause serious problems with breathing, eating, and speech. Many parents lack the money or access to a simple operation that can correct it. On today's edition of Now, David Burt introduces us to physicians who have been for decades providing free operations for children with cleft palate. First, we stop by the American Cafe, where Ira Melman has a unique reunion between mothers and their children.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. About 70,000 mothers are serving time in U.S. prisons. They rarely see their children, get to touch them, or even sing them a lullaby. Female inmates in New York City are getting a little help with that last item thanks to Carnegie Hall. Jeff London spent a few days with the musicians and inmates in New York's largest jail, Rikers Island, to see how Lullaby Project works.
It's a frigid morning, and five professional musicians have made their way through a maze of checkpoints to a small classroom where they'll work with 10 prisoners, women who are either detainees awaiting trial or women who are serving out their sentences at Rikers Island. After they meet each other and sing together,
Tiffany loves you, love is magical, love will keep you safe.
Naisha.
The women move to different corners of the room to start writing lullabies. In one corner, Kelly, the Department of Corrections will only allow the women to be identified by their first name, is working with Indian classical singer Falu Shah. The two have come up with a chorus.
You and I go together, all right? Okay. 1, 2, 3.
I wonder if you know how much I love you. I wonder if you know how much he loves you.
But Shaw says she really had to coax Kelly to write her lullaby.
She was actually crying. She was very sad. And, you know, we were talking about our kids, my child and her child, and we just connected becoming mothers for a second because she was not able to write anything. So I started talking to her about my son, and then she started to talk about her four children.
The song is written from two perspectives, Kelly's and that of the children's late father.
They lost their father recently, and fortunately, the two younger children, they don't really know much about what's going on. And even though me and him weren't together, he was there for the children. And so I really wanted to get the message to the older ones, especially, that their father's still around and that he's looking down on them so that they feel some sort of comfort, you know, since I can't be there physically.
To be able to give those children something, anything, means a lot, says Veronica Scudder, who helps coordinate programs for the women at Rikers Island.
For them to have the opportunity to write a song for their children is really, really a nice feeling. And that's where you see their face light up because they feel like, wow, I'm really doing something. And I'm doing it in a jail. That's unheard of.
When the day ends, the musicians leave and get to work, says Falu Shah, in a Manhattan recording studio a week later.
I wonder if you know how much I love you. I wonder if you know how much he loves you. I wonder if you know how much I love you. I wonder if you know how much he loves you. I hope you know how much I love you. When I'm not with you, please stay together and love each other for.
A week later, the musicians have returned. returned to Rikers to play their finished lullabies for their co-songwriters. Kelly is overwhelmed by Falusha's setting of her lullaby.
And now that I heard everybody's songs, it's just, they're all so beautiful. You know, when it comes to our children and stuff, maybe it brings out the best of us.
For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Join us daily at voanews.com.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. For the past 32 years, a group of doctors have been voluntarily restoring smiles to people across the world. Operation Smile, as it's known, was founded in 1982 by Dr. Bill and Kathleen McGee. It has operated on nearly 250,000 children born with cleft lips or palates. All of the doctors are volunteers. For the past 25 years, Operation Smile has been restoring the smile to children in Vietnam. The organization recently marked that milestone by operating on hundreds of children simultaneously in five different locations in Vietnam. Bill McGee told the Reuters news agency that it's a privilege to help others.
Every day in medicine, we get the privilege to put our hand on another person's shoulder and make their problem our problem, to show them love. If we can learn to do that more, and every time in our lives, every day of our lives, we'll be happier people, and we'll make other people happier people.
Scientists do not know what causes cleft palate, but some believe it could be a combination of genetic and environmental factors. The organization is using technology to help fight the condition. Each child has a medical record in a data system on the cloud that is geotagged to help doctors learn about their treatment. Ruben Ayala is Operation Smile's Senior Vice President of Health Affairs.
It's good to be able to treat a kid, but if we prevent it altogether, that's even better. So with technology, we're able to learn from our patients. Our patients have a richness of lessons that they can give us. So if we know that the genes that are on a cleft lip and palate patient are only triggered by specific things, then I'm able to prevent those things.
For Bill McGee, the program helps not only the patients, but also the doctors.
We've got to get back to the basics of what makes us feel good. And that's what, to me, Operation Smile is. It's just using our talent to help somebody else have a little smile on their face.
Operation Smile's website says that 1 in 700 children worldwide is born with cleft palate. A child born with the condition can suffer from breathing problems as well as have difficulty eating or speaking. There are also cultural prejudices against many of these children, but Operation Smile's work changes all that. Dogs are often called man's best friend, but a new study could make that bond last even longer. Researchers at the University of Washington are testing the anti-rejection drug rapamycin in dogs to see if it slows the aging process. Matthew Kaeberline is one of the researchers. He told Reuters the tests in mice have been very promising.
It's not just lifespan that's extended, but many age-related declines in function are also improved by rapamycin. So cardiac function is improved, cancer seems to be delayed, immune function, at least to some extent, is improved, cognitive function is improved. So it's not only that the mice are living longer, they're healthier longer into later age.
The drug works by targeting a protein that regulates how rapidly cells reproduce. It also increases cells' ability to manage and recycle waste, and that will help slow the aging process. Co-researcher Daniel Promislow says that the wide variety of dog breeds in the world will help researchers take into account a wide variety of genetic differences.
One of the amazing things about dogs is that they are more variable than any species on the planet. All you have to do is put a Great Dane and a Chihuahua side by side, and even a little kid can tell you, yes, this is an incredibly variable species.
Kaeberlein says that his study could prove to be a game changer in the area of preventive medicine.
This is a much more efficient approach to promoting health than waiting until people are sick with the disease and then trying to treat the disease at that point.
Researchers hope if the tests in mice and dogs are successful, that human trials could be in the near future. So what do you think? Let us know your opinion on these stories by visiting our Facebook page, VOA Asia. Until next time, I'm David Berg.
This is VOA Global from the Voice of America. An Arkansas veterinarian had an interesting task before him. He had a dog that ate 23 live rifle rounds. The dog apparently ate the bullets out of a bag that his owner had by his bed. His owner says that he's not going to leave ammunition lying around anymore, but isn't optimistic that his dog will stick to dog food. This is Sports from VOA Global. I'm Jim Stevenson. It may have been the inaugural Afrasia Bank Mauritius Open Golf Tournament, but its dramatic finish rivaled the conclusions of other well-established events. South African George Coetzee emerged the winner in a playoff, as we hear more from Mark Tompkins in Mauritius.
South Africa's George Coetzee is the inaugural Afrasia Bank Mauritius Open champion after beating the Dane Torbjørn Olesen on the second playoff hole. They both finished level on 13 under par. Coetzee shot a final round 69. He needed a birdie on the last to take it into a playoff, having dropped a shot on 16.
As we walked up, I think I saw that my name was not at the top, and I realized that Torbjørn was obviously a birdie the 17th hole. And I told Alan, I was like, I can't believe it, but he birdied 17. And I thought to myself, you know, I must just give myself a good opportunity at an eagle on the 18th hole, and hopefully he doesn't birdie it and I'll have a chance.
Olesen put the pressure on with a birdie of his own on 17. He finished with a round of 68, but in the end he lost out on the second playoff hole.
I had the chance on 18 also. I hit a bad 3-iron out to the right and then difficult bunker shot, but I'm pretty pleased with the way I handled things today also. I had a bad start again and fought my way back, and yeah, it was just a lot of fighting out there, and George just played a little bit better.
Coetzee almost won it on the first hole with the eagle putt just rolling across the cup, but he closed it out, his second win of the year, having won the Shwane Open in Pretoria just a couple of months ago. Marden Mamat finished in third place after a final round 67, and South African Thomas Aitken, who'd been in the final group with his fellow countryman Coetzee, had to settle for fourth place. But it's Coetzee's title, this first tri-sanction event between the Sunshine European and Asian Tours. He's beaten Torbjørn Olesen on the second playoff hole.
Mark Tompkins reporting. In tennis, Andy Murray of Britain topping perennial clay court master Rafael Nadal of Spain 6-3, 6-2 to win the Madrid Open.
I wasn't expecting this a couple of weeks ago. So, you know, when things are unexpected, it tends to, you know, it feels nicer. I didn't feel like I put too much pressure on myself the last couple of weeks, which is a good thing. But yeah, I mean, obviously to win a Masters Series on clay for me is, you know, a step in the right direction. It's something I'd never done before. And obviously to win against Rafa on clay in a final in Spain is, you know, an extremely difficult thing to do. And yeah, I'm proud that I've managed to do that.
The French Open begins in 2 weeks. That's sports. I'm Jim Stevenson.
This is Science World Express. I'm Rick Pantaleo. NASA planners are already working to overcome a number of obstacles that could hinder or even prevent a successful manned mission to Mars. The most important challenge they must meet, of course, is making sure that the Mars travelers are kept safe and healthy throughout their long trip to and from the Red Planet. But new research may have uncovered another wrinkle in successfully meeting that challenge. It turns out that astronauts who make the long voyage to Mars will be subjected to long-term exposure to high-energy particles such as those found in cosmic rays. After conducting experiments on rats, a team of researchers led by Charles Lamoli at the University of California at Irvine found that long-term cosmic ray exposure can cause significant damage to the central nervous system, resulting in cognitive impairments such as dementia. Namoli said that astronauts exposed to the high-energy particles over the 2 or 3 year trip face memory deficits, lose their focus, as well as their sense of awareness, all of which may seriously affect performance of various mission-critical activities. Professor Namoli joins us today for our one-on-one segment to talk about his team's research, findings, and what steps will need to be taken to protect those who travel to Mars from such harm.
NASA has known about these radiation fields for years, and I would argue that our findings are certainly not a showstopper, but it provides further information concerning the risks of travel in space that NASA needs to be aware of so that they can be prepared. And so what we did was we investigated how these charged particles, which can traverse the hull of a spacecraft and obviously the tissues of your body, what they do to the brain. And what we found is that following a relatively brief exposure, 6 weeks following this, animals, when tested on a series of behavioral platforms, performed quite poorly compared to unirradiated animals. Then when we went in to look at those regions of the brain that were interrogated by these cognitive tasks, we found the neurons to have some significant structural alterations that basically compromised the structural integrity of these cells. As you can appreciate, we can't simulate what happens in space perfectly here on Earth. The dose rates up there are relatively low, and we cannot, for example, keep an accelerator running for 3 straight years to run an experiment. This is simply just not practical. So what we do is our best approximation. So we pick the very types of charged particles that are present in galactic cosmic rays and expose animals to space-relevant fluences or doses that the astronauts would receive over the course of, for example, 10 to 30 days. And we analyzed the consequences of this, and what we found suggests that there's some risk associated with exposure to these GCR spectrum.
The kind of risks you're talking about aren't temporary. These are permanent damage? Damage?
That remains to be seen. And so the structural alterations we see in neurons don't appear to resolve, or if they do, it occurs over a very longer time frame than what we did in this study. The changes in cognition, I would hesitate to use the word permanent, but there are deficits that the animals showed that would indicate that astronauts could exhibit some difficulties in acquiring new learning, problem solving, or responding to some unanticipated situations. You know, what precisely that deficit in space would be is impossible to predict. I think the way to really view this is that there's an increased risk of some adverse event occurring, which would probably more likely be something relatively subtle than dramatic.
The space program has been in effect for over 50 years. Why haven't the astronauts who have gone, for example, to the moon or those who were aboard the International Space Station facing this kind of problem?
So the astronauts on a space station are still protected by the Earth's magnetosphere. And these particles get deflected by that. So they're not going to get exposed at the same levels they would going to Mars. The astronauts that went to the moon would have been exposed, but keep in mind the duration of this mission was very short. And, of course, on top of that, the number of astronauts up there is relatively small. We analyzed 60 animals in this study, and, you know, if we had analyzed maybe only 12, we might not have seen significant effects. And so it's a combination of never having a person out exposed over these durations in the past Earth's magnetosphere that I think NASA has reason to be concerned about.
That was Charles Namoli, a professor of radiation oncology at the University of California at Irvine. Thanks for listening to Science World Express. I'm Rick Pantaleo.
A monkey born in a Japanese zoo will be keeping its name Charlotte after all. Owhite City officials settled a national debate over whether calling the monkey Charlotte offends its British royal namesake or not. The officials said Friday they will stick to their first choice because there was no protest from Britain's royal family. The name flap began Wednesday when the popular Natural Zoological Garden named a newborn Charlotte, which was the favorite in a public ballot. But immediately after that decision was announced, the zoo was flooded with protests, with some Japanese who said it was disrespectful to the British royals. Officials took seriously the views of both sides until the mayor became involved, endorsing the decision and saying that the monkey is given a wonderful and cute name, Charlotte, and I think that we should stick to Charlotte. And so they did. Well, the seniors at Arkansas City High School want to get rid of their school. They think the building is unnecessary after the class of 2015 graduates. The Winfield Daily Courier newspaper reports that as a senior prank, the seniors listed the Arkansas City High School building for sale on Craigslist. The ad says the class members don't need the building anymore, but they do need money for college. It notes the school offers a lot of parking space or even a room for a buyer's cattle, and whoever buys it might even learn something. The ad lists a price of $2,015, but says all offers will be considered. As this is the last week for VOA Global, maybe we should put it on Craigslist as well. Our director is Tracy Carter, our engineers, Kelvin Fowler and Zainab Abdel-Rahman, and our managing editor, Diane Gao. I'm Jim Stevenson. Join us again tomorrow.